Welcome to the Hardware Asylum Podcast. This episode, we talk about why you need a 3D printer and manufacturing of custom PC components. I'm your host, Dennis Garcia, and with me today, I have Darren McCain. The fall season is in the air, and it is finally getting nice here in the city of Boise, Idaho.
Woohoo! So we have the smoke, of course.
Yeah, a little bit of smoke, but that happens at the end of the season. So we have the garage door open, so if you hear this random car going by, please keep that in mind. But I thought we would talk about 3D printing.
You know, right.
Kind of get away from the PC side of things and look at a more kind of an advancing hobby that's been advancing for a really long time.
Well, I feel like it's not a big stretch because we like enthusiast hardware, and 3D printing is still pretty solidly in the enthusiast hobbyist world.
Speaking of, though, it's like we have different levels of 3D printers. You have some that you can buy for almost $5,000.
Oh, yeah.
That are just a desktop unit, and they're complete. I mean, you just unbox it, and you plug in your filament and plug in your stuff, and it goes.
Hopefully fail-proof.
Hopefully. But then you also have the what I would call like the enthusiast style 3D printers, where you have these pieces and parts and you just assemble what it is that you want.
Yes.
And that is what really interests me a little bit about 3D printing and really what started this topic discussion, because you have one of those units.
I do, actually. I bought this 3D printer, I guess it's been a couple of years now. And, you know, like all things, sometimes it gets really heavy use and sometimes it doesn't. But it seems like I've always got some sort of project in mind.
Oh, of course. So let's start. What 3D printer do you have?
Well, after quite a bit of research and discussion with other hobbyists that already had 3D printers, I went with a CR10S, which is from a company, I always call them Creality. I think that might even be right. They have a lot of different models. And what drew me to them was very expandable, very upgradable. The comments where people say, well, you can use this printer to completely print a new 3D printer if you really wanted to.
That's cool. Well, what prompted you to get a 3D printer to begin with? Because, you know...
What prompted me?
You know, it's like any sort of a hobby, right? It's like, well, there's usually a driver to get you into the hobby, and then after that, it can take off, or you can go and throw it in the corner.
Yeah, well, years ago, I supported printers for a living back when I first got into the tech world. And so to me, having something that was, I guess, not quite mainstream was not as daunting as it might be for some folks. I mean, a printer is a printer in theory, right?
Oh, of course, yeah.
So that's the first thing that you have to overcome is how comfortable you are with this emerging technology. And once I got through that, what I did is I started to see cool stuff being printed. You know, in the board game world, people are printing board game bits and pieces. But what really convinced me was some of the cool stuff that was coming out of some of the conventions we've gone to, like PAX, for example.
Oh, right.
Where folks were printing really cool props and costumes. And I thought, well, that's not really my thing, but it's super neat.
Well, and it's an easy way to make a prop if you don't know how to make a prop.
So I kept seeing cool stuff that I could build, and I thought my kids would think it's neat. So, you know, putting toys together for them and little action figures and stuff, you know, you could customize them to look like them. I mean, it just had sort of endless potential.
Oh, of course. So I started looking into 3D printing myself, mostly for a side project for the YouTube channel where I'm going to 3D print computer parts. And I thought, hey, Darren has a 3D printer, so maybe he can let me borrow it for a little while.
Absolutely.
And we brought it over. It's in the lab right behind me. I'm pointing... Woohoo. Nowhere because radio. Huh? And, you know, I've started researching these, and you told me it was a Creality 10S. Well, that one doesn't look like what's in the magazine.
Well, not entirely, although it's not that much different, I guess. But this kind of goes back to the comment that I just made, that one of the advantages of buying particularly the CR10S, because it's one of the most common and, I might add, most cloned models in the world, is there's so much aftermarket support for it. So I almost immediately started upgrading it.
Well, and this is, as I mentioned before, this is like one of the enthusiast models. You know, I've done some research. So it allows you to pretty much replace anything. Like, for instance, you redid the base on this thing.
Well, yeah. Well, let's talk about that a little bit. Think about this in terms of it being like a regular printer. So a lot of us older folks, will out you out there, are used to the old dot matrix or plotter printers.
Right.
And this really functions a lot like a plotter printer, except for instead of dropping ink on the paper, it's dropping, you know, ABS or PLA or whatever material that you're melting onto the paper.
And it has a third axis.
Yeah. Well, so you can go up, right?
Yep.
So actually, that's a great point. So as you can imagine, it's got the XYZ axis. So there's a lot of stuff moving. So when you buy a 3D printer, there are a couple things that you almost immediately start to work on. One is, how can I get the print quality better? And two is, my God, this thing is loud. How do I make it quieter?
Well, and the loudness is because it's cheap.
Right? Yes, exactly. And it's not in an enclosure. So some folks start by building or buying enclosures for them, and they stick them inside these things. And there's some advantages and disadvantages to that, but maybe the biggest thing is that it's inside of an enclosure, and that's kind of inconvenient.
No, yes.
So what I decided to do instead was work on taking the vibration out of the print head, which is how you improve print quality. Started by buying a improved frame for it. So now it's a full frame instead of just a single Z-axis. It's got a square too. You'll have to send a picture out when we can send this out.
Yeah, we can put some down in the show notes. But speaking of the frame, though, this is a squared off frame. So you just basically... Because the Z-axis was a single panel or a single set of bars that went straight up.
Right.
Well, this one is the bar going straight up, and then you have a bar coming across horizontally, and then another one coming down to attach to the frame at the very front of where the print base
is. Exactly. Well, the goal is to take any vibration out of that Z-axis because, I mean, it's like, say you stick a post in the ground, right? And you start to wiggle the bottom of it even slightly, then the top amplifies it, and you get this kind of wiggle thing.
Right. Well, and the reason I mention that is because the Creality 3D printers you can buy that are the Max Edition or whatever, they have a triangulated bar that connects the top of the Z-axis to that base. Instead of doing a big square, it just has a couple of bars.
Yeah, and you can get those, but the square is almost overkill, maybe.
Yeah.
Because you have a lot more strength to it because you have that additional brace across the front. So there's that. And then I noticed I was getting some noise from the print surface. So I have this on top of a desk piece. It's a nice flat surface, pretty level, which is helpful.
Yes.
But it was moving around a little bit on the desk. So I printed these feet, for lack of a better term. What they are is they are cups, Dennis, and they hold squash balls, actually, in them.
Well, that's creative.
Ironically, it's kind of difficult to get squash balls in the United States. They're a little bit harder and smaller than racquet balls.
Oh, yeah. Well, we don't play squash in the U.S.
So they act like soft rubber dampeners, as if you had rubber feet, say, on an old stereo equipment piece or something. So anyway, that was next. And then, of course, that raised it up a little bit. So I built some accessory trays to go under it, some drawers, some racks to hold the control unit.
Oh, yeah. I noticed that it was lifted up and... That's primarily so that you can keep the filament entering the machine at the same level.
Exactly. So if you're an over-under guy in toilet paper land, this is an under method. So you feed off the bottom of the spool in through a filament detector, which is optional. Actually, it's one of the nicer add-ons for a higher-end model that tells you that the filament is still there and in. So you want that as straight as possible because your filament is kind of delicate and you don't want to introduce any kind of kinks that'll keep it from feeding. So I do have some additional stuff that we've been talking about doing. We have some beautiful Noctua fans that we're going to replace the primary blower fan on the extruder, which is the printing head.
Yeah, it's the one that just keeps the head in check.
And so that one's always on. It's a little bit noisy because it blows a lot of air from a very small fan. And then the actual control box itself has at least one relatively large fan on it, and it's kind of noisy too.
Yeah, it sounds like the bearings are going out.
Well, you know, it's like you'd expect from something like this. The parts that aren't important are kind of cheaply put together, and the parts that are important are nice but can be nicer. But anyway, the printer's in a mostly finished state now, and I feel like it's kind of like any good car project. There's always something more that you want to do, and eventually you just maybe give up and buy a new one. I don't know.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's it's like upgrading a car, right? There's a certain point when you could keep going,
right?
But you're going to outpace some piece and part, so you might as well just get a brand new car and just kind of start over.
let's get back to you, because you wanted to try to do a project on the printer. So I thought it would be a good opportunity for you to learn something about 3D printing.
Yeah.
And work on your project. Now you have, I think some folks out there know, a background in design, and that's maybe an important place to start.
My background is in architecture. That's what I went to school for. So I know how to design buildings, do blueprints, and part of that was to introduce myself with 3D modeling. So I took a couple of classes that were somewhat required to learn how to do models. In AutoCAD, 3D modeling was relatively new, is somewhat difficult to do, but with 3D Studio Max, you could make computer models, just like what they make movies out of these days. And ironically, I made a couple of movies, which is really weird, because you would have this model and you'd animate a model, and then you had to render out every frame. So if you wanted to 30 frames per second, you had to render out 30 frames, and you would only get 1 second of video. And then you recompile it together in Premiere, and now you have a 1 second video.
Woohoo!
Which is actually kind of fun. But it gave me the experience of putting models together and how to actually, you know, manipulate them.
Now, that's an area that I don't have as much strength in, to be honest. So generally, when I print something, I'm working off of an existing model and do very minor modifications or resizing, for example.
Well, and since I do have that design background, I modeled up what I wanted to print in AutoCAD and then started to extrude it and start removing pieces. And I basically created what I wanted, and I have it here on the desk.
Woohoo!
So ultimately, I have two projects that I want to build for the retro stuff for Hardware Asylum, which is the Hardware Asylum Vault and some of the retro projects that I have on the YouTube channel.
So if you haven't tuned in to some of our previous retro podcasts, Dennis has been pulling older hardware out of the vault, and he has a lot of it, and trying to get it up and functional again. So we have some really old machines and old parts in the lab, and what we've discovered is it's very difficult to get pieces, parts for those processes.
Yeah. Well, and retro computing is fun for the fact that it's retro computing, but there's really absolutely no reason in the world. Some people may disagree, but there's no reason to fire up an old Intel 8088 and play games on it, because those games are very, very dated. And, you know, you see some of the YouTube channels that go and restore these old machines. Well, all you ever see them do is install DOS.
Yeah.
And make it work. Well, and I want to take it a little bit farther. I mean, I have my one of my first motherboards that I ever built an actual computer in. I still have it, and I would like to get it working again. Well, when I pulled that out of the vault and started to install Quake on it, I was actually going to play Quake, the original Quake, the way that's supposed to be with 3DFX cards and whatnot. Well, I could not find an IDE hard drive to save my life. I don't have them anymore, and all I had was SATA drive. So I'm getting these adapters so that I can hook in these old hard drives. Well, that got me thinking. It's like, well, when you are putting a retro machine together, some people say you have to have the purity, making sure that you're using the period correct hardware. Well, I don't really want to do that.
Well, no.
And the project that I decided to come up with was a hybrid. So you remember way back when some of the very first hard drives were these big honking chunks of metal, and they might have 20 megabytes of storage.
Oh, yeah. Those were big old beasties.
Well, there were several of those drives, and these are huge. They're like, some of them are full height, which, believe it or not, that's 2 5 1/4 bays. 5 1/4 wide by 2 bays high. That's a full height hard drive way back when. And now we have 2.5 inch ones, which are fit into a laptop. So technology has advanced a lot. Well, and we also had half height drives, which were a single bay, 5 1/4 inches wide. They were very ornate because they were also very expensive. So these companies that made them actually took the time to stamp details into them. Some of it to, you know, increase strength, and others just to make it have a little bit of curb appeal. We'll call those the MFM drives because that's the file format that they used. And I wanted to replicate one of those MFM drives, tweak it a little bit, but then make it an empty shell so I could put in a SATA to IDE adapter card.
Oh, I see. So it's almost like the concept of a resto mod in a car world.
Yeah.
It looks like the old part, but inside it's a modern.
Yeah, so this little adapter card is an IDE interface, so that will interface with these old motherboards that I have. But I have a SATA drive inside of it, so I can actually use a real modern SSD or a SATA SD card reader, which is also kind of fun. But the idea is that I printed this shell so that this adapter will fit in there, you know, lock in place in the back.
Right.
And then I have another 3D printed part here, which will hold the SSD drive and screw into the bottom of this part that I printed.
Yeah, it's a mounting plate, right?
Yeah.
An adapter, for lack of a better term.
Yep. And the cool thing about this little adapter is that it has an LED light on it. And a lot of these old MFM drives had the activity light on the bezel for the hard drive. That was the way that you knew that it was being active, because this was a long time before they started adding the LED light to the case. By using this adapter, I can wire in an LED, and then I have a shell that I bought off of eBay, which is a 5 1/4 to 3 1/2 inch adapter that comes with a faceplate with an LED light provision in it. So it makes it look like these old drives. I just need to have the shell to mount everything together.
All these years we try to make things smaller and you're making them bigger.
Yeah, but it's going to be awesome.
Well, I have to admit the finished product looks pretty sharp.
Well, and I printed two of them. And this was where I was learning a lot about 3D printing, because as Darren had mentioned, he just downloads the STLs and then prints something cool, which there's nothing wrong with that. That's actually the whole reason that Thinkverse and all these other places are around.
Exactly.
Well, since I had something custom to build, I modeled it in AutoCAD and then extruded it out, you know, got my calipers out to make sure that I had the dimensions correct, actually modeled the part that would hold the adapter piece, which I printed it once and screwed it up and modified it, and then I printed the final piece. You'll notice that the top of the drive here, and I'll post these down in the show notes.
So this is attempt number one.
Attempt number one. It looks different than attempt number two.
Yeah, it does.
Well, that's because I changed the orientation. So the first time I printed it, I was thinking, well, we have this notion of support when you're 3D printing. So anything that gets an overhang needs to be supported, otherwise it will fall.
Well, that makes sense, because you can't put material just on air. No. Something's got to hold it in place.
Yes. So I decided that I would try to save filament, and I printed it upside down. So the face of the drive was on the build surface. And then I'll flip it over. And then basically I printed up. So the only part that needed to have support was these edges here around the drive and the support piece in my logo and then the details on the top of the drive.
Right. Now I see you still have the support structure in a lot of this.
And that's because it would not come out.
Oh no.
So one of the things with 3D printing is that the slicer will go and build in the support and then builds in a breakaway so that you can just grab it and it should just pop away from the whatever you're printing.
Right.
The thing I noticed is that on these, since the support was inside a hollow piece, the support made contact with the outer frame or the outer edge that I was printing.
Oh, just enough to hold it, huh?
Yeah, so I could get them out of there, but I would have to basically take a Dremel and a little grinder and brrr the whole thing out. I'm like, well, this is just a test piece to make sure that my idea would work and then finalize what I needed to finalize. So when I printed it again with my modifications, I flipped it over in the slicer. So now I'm using a lot more support, but the top of it has much nicer look, and all of the support, you know, flashing, I guess is the term here.
Sure.
All of it's on the bottom, so you would never see it.
Interesting. I wonder if you could have printed it horizontally instead of, or vertically rather, instead of horizontally. But
well, and I thought about that as well, but this is only a single bay wide at that point. So if I go vertically, yes, I would have a much higher Z-axis because it'll go up like 6 or 7 inches.
Which is a higher risk.
Higher risk of falling down and whatnot. It would have actually printed differently where I had lines across the entire face all the way to the top. Whereas if I printed it down, all I get is this little checker pattern.
Ah, clever.
So, yeah. So I figured, well, I print it this way. And then what I can do is just take some sandable primer, some automotive primer. I know how to paint automotive stuff. And basically spray the whole thing down, and that will fill in all of these little gaps and smooth it out. I can just do a little wet sand on it And then I can paint it any color I want, and you will never know.
And it's going to look, at least to all but the most discerning eye, I guess, like a big giant hard drive.
Well, and that's the idea. Of course, some of my little details are probably a little deep into the plastic. You know, the stamped ones on the actual drive are just like a millimeter under the surface. And these are like a 16th of an inch. And then, you know, the big thing that gives it away is I have the Hardware Asylum logo down in the bottom, which I figure, you know, if I'm going to be 3D printing a part for a website project, I should at least have a little representation on there.
Well, that's why you get a 3D printer, right? So you can totally customize what you're putting together.
Mm-hmm. But the whole... diesel trucks are always the worst.
For lots of reasons.
Okay. So working on this project has taught me a lot about 3D printing. And it much like painting a car or a trailer or a motorcycle or whatever, it's all in the preparation. And that's something that they're very vague on. If you go and read a tutorial or watch a video on 3D printing, they're very vague on the setup. It's like, you have to do this, you have to do that, you have to do this, and then it should just work. But they never really talk about, well, when it doesn't work, how to fix it.
Oh, yeah, there is a lot of talk always on the threads about, hey, look what happened. Someone tell me how to fix it. Or, you know, the experimentation aspect of it, which is part of the fun if that's something you're into.
Well, and I printed three different versions of that XYZ...
calibration cube.
The calibration cube, yeah. And that that's an important piece because it doesn't take very long to print, and it's large enough that if you have bad bed adhesion, it won't print. But if you have your settings set correctly, it will print just fine. And then you can also adjust your layer height so that you can get the vertical walls as smooth as possible, and you can work on your different versions of infill. It has every piece that you need to actually be able to quickly print something to verify your G-code settings.
Yeah, which is really cool. And I think we should say, well, what's a G-code setting? That sounds very technical.
Well, as Darren had mentioned, the 3D printer is a lot like a regular printer in that the print head moves back and forth on a trunnion, and that there's basically some gears that move it back and forth. Since the print head moves back and forth, the base is where you get your Y axis. So it moves the opposite direction, and that's how you can orient the print head anywhere on that build surface, just by moving those two axes around. And then you add your Z axis, which goes up. The G code is the programming for the controller to tell the stepper motors where to put what and when to do it. So it's basically a text file, an ASCII file that has a whole bunch of coordinates in it, and the controller reads one line at a time, and it just goes through until it finishes the script.
I think that's kind of a good description of it. Now, I've been 3D printing off and on for a lot of years, and to the point where I almost don't remember the basics anymore. You just sort of assume things are going to work if you have the right profile set up and they're a good pattern. Mm-hmm. But you coming to it fresh, maybe you can come with a fresh perspective and you know, what do the setup look like? What are the gotchas?
Right. Well, the first gotcha was, well, it's not really a gotcha. I went to go pick up the printer and I said, hey, so give me the 5-minute demonstration so I don't break nothing before I get home.
All right.
And so, you know, you showed me how to load stuff into the controller off the SD card. You showed me how you leveled the bed, which is important when you move the device to make sure that the bed is level. And that's the importance there. I'll get to it in a little bit. Then it was a matter of just going through the menu to find other settings. Like there's an option to send it home. So it moves the print bed all the way back and moves the extruder all the way to the left so that it's actually at the 0-0 point on the print bed. And that's actually important because that's where it's going to zero itself out so it knows where to print and how far it needs to travel and whatnot.
Right.
Yeah. And then there's, you know, the preheat settings and stuff like that. And a lot of that is in the slicer. And that is where a lot of the configuration is. So the slicer will go and determine the print head temperature, the bed temperature, how fast everything moves, how much material is coming out the extruder, and all of those settings impact quality, and they really need to be tuned to the way that your hardware is set up.
I think that's a pretty key point to make. Now, I want to clarify, the slicer is the printing software.
Yeah.
And they call it a slicer because it really can dissect your 3D object into slices, individual layers, if you will.
Yep. And that's important because there is a setting in the slicer for layer height. And that is how thick of plastic is being laid down from the extruder. So when it goes through one layer, if it's 0.1 millimeters, you have to do 10 layers to go 1 millimeter up. And the idea is that because your layers are so small, the side of your object should be really, really smooth and gives you a much higher quality print.
But there's a trade-off.
There's a trade-off because every time you change that, it adds time to the print exponentially. So what might take 10 minutes to print, if you change the layer height, it might take 4 hours. And that's a lot. It doesn't necessarily use any more plastic, but it has a much higher chance of failure because you are printing for much longer. And in some cases, you don't get that quality increase that you would expect. You know, that's one thing I notice is that your printer loves to print at 0.2 millimeter.
Right.
Anywhere above that, and the print quality is really bad for some reason. Anything below that, and it doesn't actually print very well. It will print, but sometimes it has adhesion problems, and sometimes it overheats, and it just 0.2 seems to be the sweet spot for the way that you have your setup.
Right, and a lot of that has to do with what extruder you have and how sensitive it is to temperature and things like that.
Yeah. Well, the one thing out of everything that I learned is that you have to level the print bed. And some fancy printers have an auto leveler.
Very nice. And it's an add-on for this one.
Yeah.
But once you know how to do it manually, you start to wonder why you would spend the money, I guess.
Now, the misnomer is leveling the bed. So some people think, well, if it's on a quote-unquote level surface, level bubble, you should be able to put a level on the print bed and it should be fine. Well,
all right.
The misnomer here is that leveling the print bed is really adjusting the height of the bed to the extruder. The way you explained it is you take two pieces of paper or a piece of paper and you fold it over, mm-hmm. and then you slide that between the extruder and the bed and you adjust the knob until it just barely catches. And the idea there is that two slices of paper gives you a certain distance. When I had trouble getting the bed level, you know, I adjusted it once and then I screwed it up and then I adjusted it again and I couldn't quite get it to work. So I went and, you know, hit the YouTubes because that's what people do these days.
Heck yeah.
And there was a guy that was explaining leveling the bed and he explained it in a different way. And it's the optimal distance between the extruder and the base is zero. And that doesn't really work well when you're trying to use a piece of paper in between the extruder and the bed. Well, the reason that it's zero is because your controller is looking to see where the Z-axis needs to be to start. And if your layer height is 0.01 millimeters, the Z-axis is going to move up 0.01 millimeters before it starts printing. Well, if the gap between the extruder and the base is too wide, it will not adhere. So all of a sudden, it's now at 0.4 millimeter gap and is trying to print a 0.1 millimeter piece of filament. There's 0.3 millimeters. I'm talking about a lot of metric here.
Yeah, yeah.
0.3 millimeters of air that needs to be taken up. He was explaining, it's like, well, your controller thinks that it's going to be at zero, and that's where it should be when you actually level your bed. But people's eyes aren't that great. And, you know, if you use a piece of paper, that's a good litmus to know how it should be. And of course, if you have a piece of glass and then you have a build surface on top of that, it's going to change the height. You have to re-level the bed. So the recommendation was to go into the controller, lift the extruder up 1 millimeter, and then use a 1 millimeter feeler gauge and basically adjust it so that it's stuck there. It just barely moves. And you want to make sure that the extruder doesn't pop up off the track because that changes the height. You just want it to be there. Then when you go to print, the controller will start at the right layer height. Now, of course, not everybody has a 1 millimeter or 0.5 millimeter feeler gauge. So he said that the other way you can take it is to get a CVS receipt, one of the really thin paper ones, and use that instead of two pieces of paper stuck together. That way you still have a gap. And it's much closer to the point where if you are printing at 0.2 millimeters, then you still have a appropriate amount where the when the filament comes out, it's going to adhere properly.
Oh, that's a nice tip.
Yeah, and that's that was the magic recommendation, I guess, that allowed me to print reliably and churn out stuff like this.
Well, very cool. Now, you talk a lot about the risk of these larger projects, and I think that that's maybe important too. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons people spend more on a 3D printer is to reduce the risk.
Right.
And the risk is that the longer your print runs, the more potential it has to shift.
To shift, to fail, for the filament to get stuck on the roll, and then all of a sudden you have a gap, uh-huh. or too much filament comes out and it starts spaghettiing all over the place. Luckily, I did not have a problem. So the two prints that you have here, my prototype took 21 hours to print. So I started it, it went overnight, and, you know, went out and did some stuff, came back, and then it was done. The second one, when I flipped it over, it had a much more support structure to print and whatnot. The dimensions are the same. The settings are basically the same. I changed the infill, so this one actually has hexagons in it, with the idea that the infill, if I used less of it, it will take less filament, and it should print a lot faster. Still has to cover the entire distance, but the fact that I had a lot more infill on the second print, it took 27 hours to complete, regardless of, you know, the everything I changed.
And that's not a bad time for a project. Generally, just for reference, perhaps, it takes about 4 hours to print a standard miniature from a game.
Yeah.
And so that's pretty good, but you don't have a ton of fine lines here, which is helpful, and a lot of solid structure.
After that, there's always the finishing aspect of 3D printing. And since I had a lot of support structure, I had to go and break that away. Luckily, on the second print, there was much larger pieces of support structure. So really, I just squeezed it a couple of times and it broke away perfectly. And then I took an X-Acto blade with a chisel tip on it and ran that underneath to get all the bridging out of there. Mm-hmm. And then I needed to hollow out this little channel here. I'm pointing on my part, by the way.
All right.
Had to hollow this out so that my support bracket would fit in there properly. And so, you know, it's sanded a bit. You get the Dremel out with a barrel sander and, you know, clean it up a little bit. And while it took 27 hours for this to complete, it was a good probably 3 hours of cleanup afterwards. And I still have painting to do. So, you know, I'm going to put down some primer. I got 4 colors to paint on this to get the design the way I'd like. And hopefully that will become a nice little video that I can put online.
Well, now that you've got some experience, I have to ask you, what do you think? Do you need a 3D printer?
Yes. I definitely need a 3D printer. You know, obviously, I'm sure I could borrow Darren's for almost indefinitely because that way it frees up his space. But I have a much larger project that I would like to do as part of this retro stuff that I'm doing. And I did a video, it's posted on YouTube, of a case that I got that was shipped incorrectly, showed up broken. And, you know, it's a retro case. They are heavy, which is one of the problems. And he shipped it in the original box, which has absolutely no packing material in it. So I'm not surprised it broke. But I wanted to print a new bezel for it. You know, it's a much larger piece, so I have to either do it in pieces and parts or print it on something else. But I know, based off of this experience of doing these, I will probably be printing that bezel 2 or 3 times before I get it the way that it needs to be. And I definitely don't want to tie up Darren's printer for that long. For more information on the topics discussed in this podcast, please consult our show notes on hardwareasylum.com. Stay up to date on the latest at Hardware Asylum by subscribing to our RSS, follow us on Twitter, or like us on Facebook. This has been a Ninja Lane production, copyright 2021. Thanks for listening.